Hey y'all, it's Match Matt. So, as you may have noticed, the Match Matt podcast does not have any ads. This means that the Match Matt podcast is completely sustained by myself and now supported through Patreon. So, at patreon.com/matchmatt, we have three different tiers for you to join. The first tier is $5 and it includes bonus episodes with the production team. The next tier, which is $10, gives you behind the scenes access such as bloopers and bonus content. $20 includes bonus episodes, behind-the-scenes content, fan requests involving interviews or guests, and monthly Ask Me Anythings. You can follow our Patreon at patreon.com/matchmatt, and you can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at matchmatt_. Remember, for Patreon, it's patreon.com/matchmatt, Matt with two T's. And also on Twitter and Instagram at matchmatt_.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Match Matt. I'm your homie, I'm your plug. You know I got extra love. And since we're talking about educators this month, I'm continuing with the episode that I was very excited for, interviewing Clint Chico. little claps. He was my high school teacher for radio and television. So everything you hear now and you will hear, I learned really from him. And yeah, so if you guys can thank him in the comments if you can. But yeah, Mr. Chico, how you doing today? Welcome to the podcast.
I'm doing fine, and thank you for that introduction. That was nice.
Thanks, I really appreciate it. So we've entered an interesting school year, to say the least. So let me just start with some basics. How long have you been teaching?
I've been teaching for almost 20 years.
So I know you as a radio and television instructor. Was that the first subject you taught?
It was the first. It's not the only one. I also spent some time teaching English and history. But most of it was in video production and radio production.
Okay. So what brought you to that? I know you said it was 20 years ago. What was that pull and draw that made you decide I wanted to teach video?
I get that question a lot, actually. I spent years doing TV news, and it's rough as a business for a lot of different ways. And I realized that what I really liked about it was the creative part, and I loved sharing that with other people. So I would learn a new editing system, something like that, and I would teach the other people that I was working with how to use it. And I really dug that. And so when an opportunity came up, there was a school that was changing over from photography to video. And this was in the late 90s. And so they were looking for somebody to basically come in and build all the classes, all the curriculum from scratch. And so that was a great opportunity. That lasted for 4 years. And then a couple years after that, DSA opened at the new building. And they were looking for someone to run the radio TV program there. And I hopped on over there and I've been there for about 13 years.
Okay. So what's the difference you noticed in between teaching usual subjects like you said, English and history in comparison to radio and television?
So there's two parts and they're pluses and minuses. One is that you get a lot of kids who really want to be in there. So like there's kids who love English, there's kids who love math and whatnot, but if you teach an art, you're going to get kids who they dig it to their heart and they really want to be there and they want to learn this stuff. And they, you know, they're going to carry it on to college or go off and create podcasts. but then you also have the kids who don't really want to be there. You know, and these are the kids who are failing other classes and other things. But when I taught English, you got to pass English, right? So I would have seniors who didn't necessarily want to be there, but you could convince them, okay, we got to get through this together. Now, the problem with an art, the problem with an elective is if the kid doesn't really care, there's not a whole lot you can say grade-wise because they don't need you to graduate.
That's true.
So that gets tricky. now, as far as teaching it, you know, I loved teaching English. I loved teaching history because there's so much in there. But the creative part, of teaching an art form, especially a technical art form, where the kids come in learning, you know, they know nothing really, because nobody learns how to shoot and edit in middle school.
No.
So they'd come to us knowing next to nothing, and you get to see light bulbs come off. You know, you get to see them create stuff out of nothing. You get to see ideas that you never would have thought of, because they think so much differently than I do, because they're younger, you know. They use music I wouldn't use. They think of ideas for shows that I wouldn't come up with. And occasionally, some of the really technically sound ones will do something, and I'll have to go back and say, okay, how did you do that? Because I've never seen that before, and that's awesome. And so that brings it to a whole new level when they are that into it, that they, you know, they grab people out of the hallway and say, come here, look and see what I made. You know, they grab their friends and they want to show it off. You don't necessarily get that with an English paper, you know, or a history test.
Yeah, that's true.
Even for people who love the subject.
I tried to show Khalil one time something I did for history, and he was like, why do I care about this? But right. I know I love history a lot, so that's something that really stuck out to me. But something that also sticks out to what you mentioned about students having that light bulb, and they would reach out and grab mm-hmm. students to the hallway and pull them in. How are you facilitating those specialty classes now during the pandemic and while we're being remote?
So we're still early in on it, right? Mm-hmm. But we're able to... So the main part of it is they make stuff, we show it off. And you can still do that virtually. You can still do that, you know, through the internet. What they're missing and what's going to be the toughest part until we get back in the classroom is the collaboration that comes with working with other people. That's harder... when you're not in the same physical space, you can, you know, you can share video files back and forth. You can share ideas and scripts back and forth, and especially with Google Docs and things like that. But what you can't do is sit down with somebody, grab the equipment, and let's go do this. And it's your idea and it's my idea, and we're going to get together and do it. So that part of it, that collaboration, is going to be what's missing the most. They're still going to be able to shoot stuff on their phones. They're still going to be, you know, the first thing we did was, okay, because like at the school, we have professional level software, professional level cameras. We can't do that right now. Just like every other teacher in this situation, the first thing you look at is what can we do? Right. Mm-hmm. We can't get together in the classroom. That's not possible anymore. What can we do now? Well, we can shoot on our phones, which now, I mean, you know, you've seen the new iPhones and stuff. It looks, it's all HD. It all looks great. And editing systems for computers, there's so many decent, not great, but decent free or cheap ones. And a lot of the kids that I've been working with already have something, not all of them. But a lot of them do, especially the ones who have laptops and things like that at home. So they've got systems that they like to use. It may not be the high-end stuff. Although I did talk to one kid who said that every, you know, every he gets a 30-day subscription for Sony Vegas, and then it runs out, and he pulls up a new email and gets a new one. And I'm like, dude, okay. Okay. But you know what? Whatever you got to do to get by. So... they're still going to be creative. They're still going to get to see each other's work. They're still going to do great things. The collaboration with other students on a, like a, you know, a personal level is, and everyone says they hate great, that they hate group projects. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's necessary. You've got to sit and collaborate with people, because there's just about every job in the entertainment industry is that. Nobody goes in and says, this is mine and my idea, and I'm, you know, and not filter it through anybody, and not have other people. Some of the greatest things that I've done has been collaborative work with other people. You know, it brings out the best in you. So it'll be good when we can get back in the classroom and they can do that part again.
Yeah, 100%, because I know that was something very big for me when I was in high school was, you know, collaborating. I knew once I signed up for the producer role and you would have them listen on the board, like after the fact, I knew that's exactly what I, you know, if I was in the industry, I wanted to produce. Like,
yeah.
I wanted to make sure everybody had what they need, that things ran smoothly, that, you know, everybody, I was a hidden hand. And so because of that, I was mm-hmm. able to see things that I could do, because since I remember I came in from Renaissance in the middle, and I know I wasn't too familiar with all the acting techniques. And I wasn't too familiar with all the editing software. So until I got there, and I just knew how to manage people and I knew how to deal with people and resolve conflicts. And because of that, I knew I could sign up for the producer mm-hmm. roles. And that showed me like what my skills and ability were before I even, you know, got those extra abilities over time. And so it's difficult for somebody who already doesn't have that. They can't fulfill that role they right. feel that they need. And even college students right. are terrible at group work. Adults are terrible at group work.
This is true.
It's absolutely terrible. So I've been working in the media for a little bit now. So I know that it's just, I could just imagine trying to get someone to edit something through email who you've never met before outside of
right.
maybe Zoom or Hangouts or whatever is being used. Somebody you don't know exactly what their skills are. You guys can't sit and, you know, brainstorm and kick it back and forth. Like, that's such a key part of the creative
it
process.
Is.
Do you know if there's any, like, if they have any, like, organizations or any groups that have been made to kind of facilitate that, you know, that kind of gap in the school?
Are you talking about like the, for the, as long as we're virtual right
yes.
now, you mean?
Like any, yeah.
Well,
like
we're working on that some. We've got a program director who the last year and a half or so has been handling the business side of running the program so that the other teacher and I can focus on the classroom part of it. And he's been really good as far as bringing in professionals and people to talk to the kids and that kind of thing. In the spring when we went virtual, we had a couple of virtual workshops, you know, and actually, I mean, you know, it's, you look for silver linings, and one of them is the fact that when everyone is virtual, then it's actually easier to get guest speakers and people to come in and talk to the kids because they don't actually have to come in and talk to the kids, right? They don't have to change their schedule as much. We don't have to try and get them into the building. You can just schedule a little 30-minute, you know, jump on to Team or Zoom or whatever and talk with them. So that part is there. And the other thing that's going to get really difficult really fast, and we haven't gotten there yet because it's still early in the year, I'm so used to being able to go in and hands-on work with the kids on a technical level. So when they're like, you know, Mr. Chico, we're having trouble with the camera because it's doing this. When they're, Mr. Chico, how do you do this in the editing system? You know, I can show them a video. I can send them to YouTube. The other part's going to be like, you know, when your grandma says she's having internet problems and you're sitting there trying to talk to her over the phone. And, well, what does your computer look like? Well, what do you see? And, you know, well, what happens if you push this button? And we've been having those problems with the other teachers, learning how to use the technology, and they throw ideas to us and we throw ideas to them because we're all learning. The kids are going to hit that real soon because what kids know how to use in technology, they know how to use really well. And getting them to learn something new sometimes can be really tricky. It does throw me a little bit. Like, I'll have kids who can create video projects, but they don't understand how to copy and paste. or they don't understand how to create a PDF using Google Docs or something like, what did you do in middle school, right?
You know? Made TikToks.
So it's weird. Exactly, yes. They can make TikToks. They can't print out an essay.
It's so amazing because
yeah.
it's something that I always thought about, like, that I've learned from people just over time in general that we've had to, like, wean out of, like, children, is that most people are incompetent at most things. So it's important that we train kids to be real rounded so they aren't as incompetent as most adults are. So I can these kids are definitely picking up, especially being,
right.
since they're so young, something I noticed about, because I was teaching and doing an education role last year, something that I really noticed about kids is how connected they are digitally. And even though we're my generation is still connected digitally very well, but I would say it's a different level for these kids. Like, these kids are, you know, content creators early, you know, they're sharing things, they're making business moves, like they're brand ambassadors at like 12 or 14. You know, it's a tons of stuff that these kids right. can do that really like that kicks in and like and sits with them. So for me, I was trying to figure out the difference, because it's a large difference between 4 years of development, right? When you're talking about teenagers or just, you know, adolescents in general.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing I want to know is the difference between the ninth graders you've received and maybe the older kids who are returning but are used to being one-on-one.
The social media aspect of it kind of, I mean, you have kids who are used to being digital and virtual ready, right? Because they communicate with each other over the phone, through text, through emails, Snapchat, Instagram. They do all that already. And one of the things that I've noticed, not just with my freshmen, but with some of the other kids too, I'm getting a lot more questions sent to me, not live in class. I mean, still some, but a lot of it is they'll send me texts through Remind. They'll send me messages through Teams. They're a lot more comfortable sending me, you know, messages that way than they would be if you sit them in class and they have to ask questions in a way that everyone can see. So the kids who are coming in who really don't know anything, or who might be embarrassed to ask questions when they're in a room full of kids who already know how to shoot and edit, and they have to ask, you know, I don't know what any of this means. I don't understand this part here or whatever. Because of the anonymity that the virtual world allows, they can text, other kids can't see it. They can send me an email or they can send me, you know, something through Teams. Other kids can't see it. Because of that, I'm getting a lot more questions that way from kids who might not be comfortable doing that. Now, the other thing is, you know, these kids are up for learning anything. The young ones are. Had a class the other day, and the kid says, you know, right near the end of class, we're about to head out. And in the chat, Mr. Chico, you like music. I'm like, who says that they don't like music? Who's going to answer that? No, I don't like music. Yeah, I like music, of course. He says, you should check out my SoundCloud. And I said, drop the link, throw it in the chat, but only do that if it's good, because you're at a school of the arts, and if it's garbage, they'll call you out on it.
Yeah.
But so he threw it on there. He's a freshman. He's got like 3 songs on there. Had like a Childish Gambino kind of vibe to it. It was hot. It was good.
Yeah.
You know. So, right? You got it, but it varies based on what the kids have been exposed to. You got some families, the kids don't have a computer. They don't have a laptop. They've got nothing. You know. And then you got some who, you know, they got the SoundCloud going. They've got, you know, at an early age. I got one kid who graduated not too long ago. As soon as he left DSA, went to college, he bought a microphone and the system and whatnot, spent like $100, turned his dorm room into a music studio, basically. I mean, like the sound baffling and the whole thing, and started producing tracks out of his dorm room. And we're all like, okay, yeah, so... The ones who want to learn fast, and if they have access to the stuff, man, then they can do magic. It's cool.
Oh, I really love to hear that, because it just makes me very excited to be in the position I'm in, to be able to, you know, after the fact, I can't wait to be able to come back to DSA so I can visit again, you know, I can help and see what the kids are working on and start to really understand, because those moments, like you building that stuff from the bottom up is such an important moment, and it says something about you overall, and it says something that you really care about the work. Because I know when I graduated DSA, I wanted to do international business, and my advisor in college told me, was like, no, you're not good at math, you should not do international business. And I was like, damn. And she was like, you know, you've been doing radio and television for years, like, you know, you might as well, you know, hop in radio and television. Yeah. And I knew that it was really me when I knew I didn't like the radio where I was staying, and I wanted to make this podcast because I just couldn't get on the radio. I was working too much. And then you know how I am. Like, you know, it's like I'm a little off the rails. So I had to really make a podcast, like buy my own equipment. And I was even borrowing from the school's equipment things for our radio and television. We got a new telecommunications building on my senior year or so. So I used to pick up and lug like lights, cameras, diffusers. I was walking from like the building to my apartment and would have to like sprawl it and put it up and be prepared for an interview and then be able to prepare to take it down and do that. So it really sticks with you, especially as a DSA student, because I know that I will have these conversations with Khalil and Nikhil and, you know, and Devin and people who still do what they do or have found, have rekindled that passion that they thought they might not have had anymore. And so when you have that ability where you can pursue it on your own, and not only can you pursue it on your own, you were taught at a young age that you can do this well, it gives you that extra confidence, and then it shows you what it really looks like instead of what it doesn't look like. So you can tell when somebody is really about their craft or really about their work in accordance and comparison to yours from being a DSA student. So that's something that I can say I really took away from being a student at DSA for, you know, just for the while that I was being there, and just the observations I've made from other people. And something else that stuck out to me when I'm thinking about the content that the students are creating. So I know we had thematics and we had film remakes and, you know, we did a few other things, PSAs. My question is, what is the content that the students are looking, what is the content they're making now? What does it look like? Is it more political because of what we're doing? What are those conversations like?
It goes one of two ways. So yeah, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of, I mean, you got Black Lives Matter all over the place. It's what people are thinking about, and it drives a lot. And I've seen that style of thing since 2014, at least. A lot of Black pride, a lot of Black girls magic, a lot of stuff like that, especially for my girls who the mindset is different. You know, it's a fist in the air kind of mindset. Now, the thing that hasn't changed and won't change, and they've been doing it since, you know, decades now, music based. These kids love music, right? Whether it's music videos or they want to put music in the videos or they want, you know, and they listen to everything. And they know everything. And they exposed me to a lot of music I haven't heard of either, which is great. But that love of music comes with youth, right? So whether it's doing radio commercials for those kind of projects or doing actual music videos or whatever, they really put a lot of thought and a lot of effort into the music that they want. We're getting virtual auditions now, right? Because the kids can't come in. So one kid sent in a video actually today, and the counselor's like, you know what, we're gonna take him just because he used Jay-Z in the background. I'm like, you know what, the track worked, it was good. They put a lot of thought into it. Kids love music, and they love music based projects or anything that they can throw music into, whether it's, you know, TV trailers and movie trailers or whatever. Yeah, that part of it is, you know, content wise, they love that.
And you'll see that now, especially during like HBO, like through Euphoria, and you'll see Lovecraft Country.
That's right.
You know, you'll see music being put in that's not even connected to the time, because most like time pieces, you would have music that's related to that time being played. But you hear Lovecraft Country, or sometimes you might hear Fargo or other things, you would have music that doesn't represent that exact time. And I think that's really reflective of where we are, and that the messages, I think they may say something about our messages repeating themselves more than it says any.
It used to be where if you were a professional musical artist, you didn't necessarily want your music out there like that because you felt like it kind of denigrated it. And, I mean, like you couldn't get a professional, you know, music artist to use their songs in commercials because they thought it lessened it somehow. And the same thing for TV and movie and whatnot. And that mindset changed over the last 20 years. And they realized, you know what, it's exposure and it's out there. And people will, you know, you'll Shazam the commercial just to see what song they're using. And the background there. Something comes up. I've seen this on TV shows. If you watch something with the closed caption on, they'll tell you what song is playing in the background so that you can go and look it up. So now you have all these artists who are like, oh my God, this exposure is great. The same way that you want your stuff on a musical soundtrack, now you want your songs in TV shows like Euphoria and the stuff on HBO. And Lovecraft and things like that, because you know people is gonna they're gonna see it. It's just another way to expose your stuff, and especially for the younger, the newer artists whose stuff isn't out there yet. Yeah, it's great for them, and it adds a whole different layer to what you're seeing in the TV shows than just a musical score, right? I mean, movies have been doing this for years, putting actual songs in the soundtrack and stuff, and it's something that TV shows are now being able to, over the last 10 years or so, pick up on that, to the point where, you know, you have guys who their entire job is to find songs to use in Grey's Anatomy or to find songs to use in whatever, and they'll call them up. We're looking for this kind of song for this kind of vibe. Hook us up with a new artist so it doesn't cost us, you know, $1 million in royalties. But we're looking for something like this, somebody who needs exposure, you know, so we can pay him a couple thousand, whatever. And it works out great for the artist, and it works out great for the show. And this is a whole, you're right, a whole different layer of emotional content for the shows and for the people who watch it. It's awesome.
Well, do you feel that... that's because content is much easier to share and create now, that people feel like they need to be more thoughtful and intentional with the type of content they make to stand out?
Well, yeah. I mean, so it works both ways. It's much easier to make content because, like you said, man, I want to make a podcast. Boom. And you can do it with, you know, scrapping some equipment and stuff together. You go back, you know, God, I'm older than the internet. You go back far enough and there's no such thing as podcasts. And to get on radio, you have to get on radio. And so there's many fewer people out there doing radio shows, right? Because it's expensive. It's prohibitive. With podcasts now, you throw some stuff together and pretty much anybody with enough effort and time can do it. Now, the problem is now you've got tons of competition. So how do you differentiate yourself? So it's the same thing with musical artists. It's the same thing with people making short films. It's the same thing with people making podcasts. If you're doing something, someone else is doing it too. So like you said, how do you make yourself stand out? How do you make yourself different? And so you do have to put a lot more thought into your content, you know. You're probably not the only person talking to teachers during the pandemic. Right. I had a friend of mine, he's doing podcasts, and he was talking to people about business side of it and how they went all virtual and how, you know, they had to manage all that kind of thing. You find your niche and you find something that makes you unique and you find something that makes you different, and you ride that because while the plus side is anyone can do this now, the downside is anyone can do this now. And so you're now all competing for the same market. If you sound the same and look the same as somebody else, someone's doing it better than you. If you do you, no one's going to do you better than you are.
That's very true. That's extremely true. And I'll say that has been a large fact for me when I first started my podcast, because podcasts, when I started, were just super hot. Like, everybody had, you know, a podcast. Like, everybody was starting one. They were like, oh, yeah, I got a podcast. This is my podcast. I'm like, damn, maybe I need to get on the radio to differentiate myself at some point of time. But when I was able to really dig into it and then find, like, what I valued and how my experience as a person changed the way I talk to people and also the way I process information, I was able to make my podcast stand out. And what's something that you noticed that's different between DSA students and maybe other students that you may, you know, meet or encounter outside of us being artistic?
The one thing I warn kids about when they come in new, like the freshmen coming in, I tell them, everyone at our school is either really, really good at what they do, or they think they are. And so we have a lot of egos and we have a lot of confidence. Now, that's a good thing in a high school student because it means it's somebody who is not going to be afraid when they jump out there and get into the quote unquote real world. You know, whether they get into the entertainment industry or they go off and become a cop or they go off and become a chef or they go off and become a doctor or whatever, that confidence will carry with them. And there's something about that exposure to the arts where you look and you say, I've done this. I've danced on stage in front of hundreds of people. I got up there and I recited Shakespeare. I got up there and I made a short film and people said, dang, that was so good. And I got likes on the internet and that kind of thing. Whatever it is, you know, I sang with the choir, you know, at the jazz festival in Detroit. Whatever it is, that confidence builds. And that carries with you. It's not just I learned to paint or whatever it is that people think art is. It's that exposure to it and the confidence that it builds, and it carries with them whatever they go into. Students from other schools who may not get that kind of exposure, you know, it's one thing to be good artistically, or academically. It's another thing to have an art form. It stays with you, forms part of who you are, and then you carry that with you outside of high school. So that even the kids of mine who go off to business, who go off to be a doctor, I've had cops come out of my classroom, I've had lawyers come out of my classroom, I've had reporters come out of my classroom, that confidence carries with you the idea that I couldn't do something before, and then I learned how to do it, and I got good at it, and I can carry that with me. And so that informs part of who you are from whatever you try and do after that.
That's very much so true. I can definitely see that with my situation. When I left high school and went to college, I knew that the way that I treated myself and my craft and just what I did in general was just different in comparison to other students who I was around. I can tell they didn't have that same energy or the vigor, or, you know, they weren't used to having people around who had greater skill or ability or more experience than them. Because, you know, even like I can say, like, there were people who were just much better than me, people who, you know, had more experience than me, had more access than me. But I think that just overall made me a better artist. And that made me, I say, mm-hmm. a better person and a better collaborator, because I was able to see that whatever I was doing was part of the larger narrative, was part of the larger art. It was part of the craft itself. And whatever I contribute to it, that someone else will do the same thing, maybe better or on the same level. So that's
right.
That's
the other part, too, is being surrounded by creativity. You know, you don't get that all the time.
You really don't. And I definitely can speak to that, because I made an organization when I went to school because I was really going crazy because I couldn't find, I mean, I could find people who were creative, because I mean, I'm in college, you're going to find people who are creative in one way or form of fashion, but it wasn't the same energy or the same environment. Mm-hmm. And it felt very like disingenuous. Like I felt for the first time that I was in an academic space when everything felt like disingenuous, especially from like just reviews on how some people would perform or just the way some people would, you know, present how they view their craft or what they're doing. Like for the first time, I felt like I was kind of starved for something when I left, because I went to a small town in Ohio for school. So you could tell it is totally different from Detroit schools. You know, like it's a totally different ball game. And so one thing that I always say that is necessary for DSA students to do is to make sure they continue to foster that community. And no matter what institution they join, if they do like trade school or something, is that they keep that community of people or keep in contact, or even when they get out, like keep doing it, because it matters. Like that work matters.
Absolutely.
That's part of your life. And being it for your formative years, you can't really strip yourself from something that made you really who you are. Like you can't be with that without feeling like you're suffocating to an extent. And that's what I felt when, you know, I left DSA. So this is like DSA was just a large part of my life. Like everybody in my family thought, I was like, oh, Renaissance is going to be it. Like it was going to make it, you know, this, that, and the third. But no, like, it was Detroit School of Arts. Like I told my mom, and I used to argue her all the time, like, mom, I want to go to art school. Like, I don't know if I want to go to college. Like, I feel like I'm talented and I want to, you know, be around talented people and express myself. And I fought her tooth and nail because, you know, I tested it. You know, you test to get into the big three in the city. So right. I fought her tooth and nail just to choose to do my audition. And, you know, it's something that I would do over and over and over again if I had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, I would never change a single moment, a single second of the time I've spent in DSA. And I really appreciated you as my teacher and my instructor because, you know, you were so cool and I was able to, you know, be myself. And, you know, you let all these wild ass kids from the city be who they are. And I truly appreciate that because there's been no like DSA. And I want to ask you a couple more questions about you. How are you handling this, you know, whole COVID thing, being remote and separate from people? How are you holding up? How are you taking care of yourself?
I live in a house with seven people. Since like March, I go to the grocery store just to get away from everybody. It works out fine. Every teacher that I've talked to, and the one, you know, they'll all tell you the one thing that we miss, the hardest part, is not being with the kids physically, because that physical energy, you know, is something different. And especially for the elementary kid teachers, you know, because you need that love. And you can't do that right now. So we miss that. We understand, too, we got to do what's safe. No one wants to go back in the classroom until they're sure that, you know, you're not going to have to write something for a kid whose parents died. You're not going to have to write something up for a coworker. You know, even not being in the classroom, I've had one person that I work with, her husband was infected, went to the hospital, was in there for about a month. He turned out okay. Found out that someone else I work with, she lost her fiance over the summer. We've had kids who've lost parents, kids who've lost grandparents, and that's without being in the classroom. So if we did get to get, you know, that's my fear. I'm not too worried about myself. I'm worried about the kids and their families. And the idea, because, if there was a safe way to do it, we'd be doing it.
Yeah.
But especially with the little kids, it won't work. And I don't want to, no one became a teacher to stay 6 feet away from everybody.
Right.
No one became a teacher so they can stand on the other side of the plexiglass, you know? But the same way, no one became a teacher so that I could stare at a computer screen all day. But we know that, and what I tell my kids, now is not forever, you know? They're like, but I want to dance. A guy came to DSA to sing and become a – yes, I get that. Now is not forever. We're going to be online for a while. We're going to work through it, and eventually we'll be back in the classroom again. And then, yeah, once it's safe, you can hug me. I'll be honest. That part, I haven't shook somebody's hand – in 6 months now.
Yes, all elbows.
Getting used to, yes, it's all elbows and fist bumps from a couple feet away and waves and, you know, I stay away from strangers. That part of the mindset's going to be hard for people to get over. You know, we're getting used to wearing masks now, which is a good thing. It's a very good thing. But yes, that mindset, you know, is going to be hard for society to get over, you know. I don't know what it's going to be like the first time I sit in a movie theater again with other people. That part scares me a little bit, you know. Somebody that I know had a birthday party and they're like, you should come over. And I'm like, I think I'm good. You know, and I saw pictures online and there's like, you know, 20, 30 of them all hugged together. And I'm like, maybe not. And even when we get back to normal, it's that mindset part's still be a little hard to get over. That's the toughest part for me is, you know, I'm okay not being around people. I really kind of am. Getting back to where I, when I am in crowd situations and stuff again, whenever it's safe for that, it's going to feel weird, you know, because that's going to be a couple months from now, at least, if not longer, you know. Everyone thinks, oh, it'll be safe in the spring. We don't know that. It'll be safe in the summer. We don't know that either. You know, football games next year might look a lot like football games this year. We don't know.
And you can't even watch a good fight.
That part's a little scary. Oh man, I'm telling you, right?
The UFC is a. I was watching a couple of fights, and when I tell you, I looked around, it was like no crowd. Like it was just the most silent UFC knockout I've ever seen in my life, and I was just like, oh my gosh! Like the basketball games are quiet. Like everything is quiet, but everybody is trying to seem like it's business as usual. But it's really not.
It's not. Yeah.
It's really not.
And that's part of the deal is you want to make it feel kind of normal, you know, because you need that. And that's what we're doing teaching too. You want the kids to feel, okay, we're getting together. It's kind of normal. And that'll work for a while. But like you said, you notice in the NBA when there's no crowd or they got the virtual screens with the fans and stuff. And it's different and it's weird and it works. It beats no basketball, you know?
Yeah, true.
But after a while, your brain is going to need something a little more than that. You know, you miss that connection to other people. And that is tough.
That's extremely tough because I think it was about the repercussions of such an event. Us as complete, just people, not even generations, just experiencing this. Like, you know, my grandmother died over the past month in, August. And for my grandmother's funeral, you can't have open, casket funerals right now. You know, so I couldn't even, you can't even bury people the same way you used to do. So I'm trying to figure out, what are these things and how do they stick with people, especially how do they stick with our kids? Because on a previous podcast, I was talking to another teacher, and she teaches, very early childhood. So she goes from infants up into preschool. And she was talking about how, she worked for a tech company with her school. So she's talking about how difficult it is and how, how stressful it is to do that with such young kids where you can't be there and you can't hold them, you can't touch them, because kids want to pull on you and ask you this and ask you that. So that lack of socialization, it worries me for a certain age of children because, and a lack of security. Lack of security for elementary kids, 10, 8, at that point in time, you need that. You need to feel secure and safe, but everyone is in a space where they don't feel safe or secure. So, what type of generation is that, does that create? Like, does it create a new form of super boomers? Like, I don't know. but it's just something that it will take a long time for us to completely process and to rationalize when it comes down to our kids and even when it just comes down to just the way we function and handle business.
It's going to be a 9/11 kind of mentality in that right after 9/11, I couldn't imagine what back to normal would look like. Like literally, I remember thinking for a month after, I can't watch a comedy. Nothing's funny anymore. Is anything ever going to be funny again? And now and then, eventually that changes and fades. And the same way you get over any major tragedy, you don't forget, but you move on. It's going to be the same kind of thing here in that this is going to affect us, years. But eventually your mindset kind of changes and gets back to the way, not back to the way it was before, but a different kind of new normal. So the kids who are going through really tough stuff now, eventually they will be okay. It will take work to get there. The same way that they needed family support, teacher support, people around them. Whenever you get over, and for any kid, any tragedy is a major tragedy because they see it that way. But here, you're right, the security's gone, the comfort is gone, the way things, and kids, and this is why elementary kids, elementary teachers are so good at structure, because they have to be, because the kids need that. They need to see their teacher every day. They need to go to the classroom every day. They need that kind of structure because it makes them feel safe. And now they don't have that right now. But what a lot of, and so there's a lot of people, well, we've got to get back to the classroom, so that they wouldn't have it there either, because what they would have in the classroom would not be anywhere close to the same as what it was before. Like you said, they'd want to hug the teacher. They'd want to run around with their friends. And you can't shake hands with somebody, and you can't go hugging on them, and you can't take your mask off, you know? So even if they were in the classroom, because there's some places where they are, right? There's some cities and some states where they just push to get right back to it.
Oh, Bessie.
It doesn't. I know, right? Yeah. Oh, God, that's dangerous. It does. It's not going to represent what they had before. It's not going to look anything like that. You know, and so that's the trade-off. You do what you can for the kids, but you also have to consider, you know, you keep them, they're comfortable, okay, but now they could kill somebody. like literally, if one of them gets sick and brings it home, and then grandma gets it and she gets sick, the kid's going to be fine. You know, there's a chance grandma might die. And that's not hyperbole. You know, that happens, has happened. You know,
right.
There was a wedding in Maine, and 100 and some odd people, and they didn't wear masks. And it became the biggest outbreak in all of Maine off of this one wedding. 8 people died. None of them were people who attended the wedding.
Wow.
So this, yep. You know, so schools can spread, prisons spread, meat packing factories and those kind of places where people are going to be close together, you know. And that's why there's so many teachers who we want to keep the families safe. And we've got older people that we work with too, that need to stay safe. We're worried about us, but we're worried about them more, you know? And once it becomes safe, we'll be the first ones to say, yes, let's open it and let's go. Cause we want to be there, but we don't want to be there unless it's safe.
You guys think it would be like a kind of a debriefing type of program when students do return, where they have like maybe curriculum that helps them kind of just decompress, just being inside?
God, I hope so.
Because I would hope so, because just the psychological, just repercussions of what's occurring is ridiculous.
Well, and that's the thing too, is how many places have a social worker? DSA does, not every school does. Exactly. How many places have, you know, counselors and nurses and people you can talk to? Not every school does. But yeah, the mental health of it, once the kids do start to get back, is going to be so important. And actually, and even now, like there's teachers who are trying to do things the old way, where the kids have to do, you know, and the rigor and the structure, and that's great. And yes, rigor and structure, and we've got to teach, and yes, but you've got to also understand these kids are going through a lot. So if they need to sit and talk, you know, I'm letting them know, you need to chat, you need to throw me an email, whatever. And I got kids who do, you know. I've got old students who are chatting with me and sending me emails and texts and things like that. Because right now we all need someone to talk to, you know. And you're right, when the kids come back, they're going to need that support. Because they're going to be all kind of different, you know. The way you think, the way you process things, the way you handle things. If you spend 6 months or more sitting at a computer screen, they're going to be different kids when we get them back in the classroom. And so we need to be prepared for that.
I agree 100%. It's something, it's a concept that I've been toying around with, that's really expressing how people are either on two extremes. Either they're showing large amounts of empathy towards other people at this point in time, or they're not. And something that I think is the cause of that is this collective and active grief, things that we're grieving for, not just people who have passed during the pandemic, not just for, you know, the uprisings and the attack by federal agents upon people mm-hmm. in Portland, and, you know, not just our whole country going to shit, just actively grieving life as we knew it.
Right.
Because it's kind of like how you described about 9/11. You talked about how you'd be watching comedy shows and you'd be like, you know, it's something, you know, things would be funny anymore. Like, will things, you know, feel safe anymore? Will things be fun yeah. anymore? So, this, I could definitely say, is something comparable to that. But the active sense of it being grief, because we can't particularly say it's mm-hmm. ended yet. It's something
right.
that sticks out and really stands with me, because I'm watching it occur around me, and I see people who are angry. I see them in denial. I see them going through all these stages that it takes them to accept that this is their current world. And right. that's something that I feel like is very important for us to deal with when we're dealing with like our students and educating them, and just dealing with our family members in general, is understanding that people may not understand that they're grieving right now, but for the most part, most of us are just grieving, trying to figure out where our security will return to.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah. Because I mean, regardless of whether or not you've lost somebody, your world has changed, your mindset has changed, everything around you has changed, and you're right that failure to accept that and understand that and roll with it, that creates a different mindset where your comparison to stages of grief is right on, because there are a lot of people who have not hit the acceptance point yet, and they are still in the denial part and the anger part, because they want their old world back. They want the ways to be the way they were. Let's open it up and let's go and we'll get together and we'll have parties and whatever, and because that's what they want. But and so you're right, that grief of their old life, of loss of their old life, that's exactly what it is. I think you're spot on with that.
And if I try not to let it bother me too much because it's out of my control, but when I think about it and I think about how we're handling it and how we're handling each other, mm-hmm. it really makes me very unsettled, because we don't know how to address it, and no one is. I'm gonna say no one is addressing it, because I know a lot of, you know, psychiatrists and therapists are taking their time to address these things, but what I'm worried about is that the citizenry won't view it that way as an active thing of grief, mm-hmm. because in comparison to 9/11, you could, you know, people were like, I'm about to go to war and, you know, fight for the country, and this is how I deal with the grief of 9/11. Yeah. But you can't do anything. You're in a complete space of inability to make change upon your life. And that's not something right. Americans are used to, unless it comes to their economy, political system. But that's not something like that we're completely used right. to. And it just that powerlessness, I don't know. Will it mobilize us to be more creative and more kind, or will it, you know, will it make, or will it just make us immobilize us? And that's what fuels me. I wouldn't even say with fear, just with I would say apprehension. Over the next mm-hmm. few years, is because we'll see the most extreme parts of ourselves, because we've been living in the most extreme yeah. situations we've really like experienced. Like no one like has experienced something like this in America. Like my mom was telling me, like I would have never imagined in my whole entire life.
Oh yeah. That, oh yeah.
You know, that this would be the case. Like same thing with, you know, even though I go on the East Side, let me let you know, I go on the East Side and I've seen tons of people without masks. I want to let you know, I'm absolutely terrified and horrified. Like I have gone to like a couple events and they're not even like large events, but like people like are not wearing masks. I wouldn't even say just on the East Side, but majority I've been on the East Side, but people are not wearing like masks anything, and it's because they feel like they have a innate inability, like especially older people,
right?
Older Black people, they'll be like, well, if it's my time, it's my time. And right. I will hear it. I've heard it so much to the point where I had to argue with my dad about it, because he was on that. So it's I get very afraid that because people feel like they have an inability to make a change, that they'll become immobilized right. and just accept their fate or the fates of other people. And I feel like with that grief, I feel like what will free them for that grief is understanding that they're not alone in that situation and that what they do affects other people.
I think you're spot on that. That's what it, yeah. And getting people to understand that is hard. One of the toughest parts of being an adult is having to deal with people that annoy you and that do things that just drive you crazy because, you know, you're not allowed to punch them anymore.
You go to jail.
No, not really. different mindsets are out there. Different ways of thinking are out there. And you can't make people see things your way. The only thing I can do and what I try and do with my kids and what I try and do with people around me is be an example. So I'm going to do things my way, which is to help as many people as I can, as much as I can. You know, I'm going to wear my mask. I'm going to, you know, stay away from people. I'm going to talk about things with my kids. I'm going to be an example for them, be an example for my students. I'm going to do things that I can. And like you said, there's you get to a point, there's not a whole lot you can do. But what I can do, I'm going to do. And some people will see that and go, okay, yes, I'm right there with you. And some people, maybe you can change a few minds, but it's hard. And you're never going to be able to do it by yelling at them. You're never going to be able to do that by jumping on Facebook and I'm going to post da 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 da. You know, that usually doesn't change anything. But if I can, look, let me tell you, I still stand up for myself. They say something, I'm going to, you know, I'll stand up for myself. But the biggest thing you can do to change the world around you is, you know, it's a cliche and I hate it, but be the change and all that. Be who you want to be so that other people see that. And if there's something that you want to see in them, you've got to exemplify that yourself. And I think part of that comes from being a teacher because that's what you do in the classroom every day, you know. But, you know, I see people online. I'm not going to vote because it's whatever. And, you know, you want to strangle them. I mean, you do. You want to go, well, God, why did they fight to give everybody the right to vote if you're just not gonna because you don't feel like it? Or you just read, you know, I don't like her. Look, your options are, you know.
Like, read the list.
It's right. If I'll tell you, look, it's like this. I love LeBron. If LeBron gets knocked out of the playoffs, I ain't watching. I ain't watching the finals if LeBron's not there because I don't care about the other teams. This is not like that. The voting is not like that. One of these people will become president. You either choose one or the other one wins. That's pretty much all it is. If you support one of them, great, do that. If you hate one of them, great, vote for the other guy. But you cannot be apathetic. Not at this point. Not on something like this, because it matters too much. And they'll look and say, oh, well, it doesn't change anything. Well, you know, whatever. Or, you know, it's the mindset of, like you said, it's my time, I'll just go or whatever. And life isn't like that. Life is a series of little tiny choices. Nothing just, you know, yes, I could go out in the street and get hit by a bus. But if I look both ways, that's a lot less likely to happen. So, you know, you can do things. Small things, little things, even when it looks like you have no options, no choices in life, is just, oh, you know, I'm screwed, whatever. Sometimes your options are teach virtual or teach in a classroom where you're not safe. And you pick, you know, you hate to say the least lesser of two evils because, you know, it's not like that. But you pick whichever one you think will work best with you and with other people. And then you find ways to make it the best option that you can make it. So that's the situation we're in with the pandemic and everything else too. None of the choices are good choices. Nobody wants to watch the Lakers play in front of an empty crowd. No one wants to watch football with canned in sound effects, you know. But what are the options? And I'll tell you this too, I was surprised they got football going.
Very surprised they got football going.
Yes. especially back in April, NBA shut down quick, right? And everything. I was like, oh, that was smart. Now, you know how much grief and hate they took, because you're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars that the NBA rakes in. And they said, nope, we're going to push it back. We're going to throw everything in, you know, Orlando or wherever they are in the bubble. I kind of figured that might work because they secluded everybody from everybody. I'm waiting to see what happens when a football player tests positive. Because, I mean, they talked to the coach at LSU, and the LSU coach said, yeah, most of the teams got it.
And you're like, what?
Yeah, and that's your reaction, is most of the teams been infected with COVID and you're okay with it?
Or whatever. Young.
We're talking about maybe we'll start. Yes, I know, right? So I'm, you know, but hey, what oh, God. So that's that. That's the main thing I was looking at, is like, what's going to happen when a celebrity passes away? What's going to happen when it's somebody that's famous? What's going to happen when it's somebody they know? Because there's so many people who think it doesn't matter unless it affects me, which is a horrible way to go through life.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know that people look at it that way, right? Right. Mm-hmm. If I'm not sick, my family's not sick, I'm cool. You know, if it's those guys, if it's somebody that's not me, hey, whatever. But God forbid, you know, a really famous celebrity pass away. God forbid one of the football players, you know.
Somebody we find valuable.
You know. Yes, that's exactly it. Yes. Someone who matters to them, you know. Mahomes gets sick, something like that. Then, oh, my God, then they'll pay attention. Yeah. If it's, you know. The guy who packs the groceries down the street, they don't pay attention to that.
Yeah, they
but
don't.
If it's somebody who's a name, who's like you said, someone who matters to me, someone who is valuable to me.
I thought yeah, we were really doing it.
It drives
was
me crazy.
When God, Tom Hanks got it. I thought when Tom Hanks got it,
yeah.
that would have been maybe mm-hmm. it. Because I'm like, oh no, Woody Forrest? Oh no. Like, you can't, you know.
Right. Yes. You know what's funny is I saw this online. Kevin Hart, a couple months after that, said, yeah, I got COVID for a little bit and I got better. I didn't tell people when it happened because it was at the exact same time that Tom Hanks got sick. And so he knew exactly what the headlines and the stories were going to be. Kevin Hart gets COVID. Oh, but it's Tom Hanks. Forget Kevin Hart.
It's like Patrick Swayze's funeral after Michael Jackson died. Like, nobody said
exactly.
anything about Patrick
yeah.
Swayze.
Yeah, and it sucks that life is like that and that culture is like that. And, you know, but yeah, it is. It is, you know. Look at all the people who've passed away recently, right? You forget about one as soon as another one hits. And it's sad and it's brutal. But, you know, people forget Kobe passed away in February. And that was massive.
Massive.
I had kids crying over Kobe, you know, and it's still... I mean, not just because he's a great basketball player, but because he touched people's
tremendous
lives
person.
With the stuff he did, you know? Oh, yeah. And then all this hits right after, and you forget stuff like that because life comes that fast, and it's crazy.
Because next thing you know, you wake up, and then 200,000 Americans are, like, dead. Like,
that's right.
My mom yeah. went to Belle Isle, and she went around, and she, you know, for the memorial they had.
And the pictures, yeah.
So the guy who was my first barber, he passed, and so did one of my coworkers from my recent job. Like, he was actually my home improvement guy, too. And so, because I don't know, because I was calling him and was texting him and was not receiving anything back. So, like, when I found out, I was like, damn. Like, and it's so crazy because yeah. how many people are just dropping and how we just... It was something that stood out to me that was bothering me greatly when Trayvon Martin passed. This level of apathy we have for people in the United States because we don't feel close to them. And a lot of times right. that's because of our digital divide. But on top of that is mm-hmm. also that
we're so used to our country just dealing with mortality in such a large way. Like, we're used to, like, you know, huge crime waves in Chicago or mass shootings or, you know, this poisoning occurred to this cult over here. Like, it's just a small, like, consummation. Like, you're consuming human life, but you're not consuming what it means for the loss of human life or how that human life is affected. And what really scares me is that people don't see themselves as change agents because they feel like the change is that much bigger than themselves.
Right.
Because you have people denying that they can make a difference, and people who are saying that they can make a difference aren't the people in power. So these people have people feeling extra disheartened about everything that's occurring in their world. And so what I've been trying to figure out is, how do we inspire people to be a change agent again? Like, how do we, you know, how do we kickstart that within our students, within our people? How do we make this a response to how Black people reacted to the civil rights movement and not how people responded to 9/11? You know, how can we change? Yeah. How can we make this something about us making social change? And how do we, I don't know. I'm not asking you to figure all those questions out, but
no,
these are just good questions. I'm just trying to figure completely out. Because it's like after 9/11, just how you talk about how people react to different tragedies, this whole QAnon shit and the way I see people react to different tragedies since then. I'm not even gonna dig into that. I got a whole cult thing actually going on next month. So, but it'll be interesting, just these responses, these extreme responses of either action or just immobilization by people.
Yeah.
It's just polarizing.
Once upon a time, my dad's, he was 80 when he passed. You go back to his time when he was kids and stuff, everybody knew everybody's name. Like, you know, you knew the people around you and you knew your neighbors and that. So my dad, we always made fun of it. He would go and he would address, you know, the tire guy by name, and he knew the cashiers by name. When you have that mindset, and everyone is connected to you, then you feel more part of that community. And that doesn't really exist anymore. And it's kind of sad, you know. I don't know the names of my kids' teachers right now, you know, because you're not connected to them. You don't see them every day. You don't, you know, even if they were in normal school, I wouldn't see them every day, you know. When you don't feel connected to the people around you, then it's a lot easier to think of them as numbers and not names. It's much easier to think of them as, you know, because you mentioned the change around 9/11, right? And everybody came together because we had that we are all Americans mindset, right?
Right. And there was an enemy.
We don't have something like that. Yeah, that's exactly right. You want to get people together, give them a common enemy. Right now, our common enemy is this invisible bug thing that no one can see. That makes it a lot harder. Although, if they wanted to unify us against it, they could, but they don't want to. whole different thing, man. You know what I thought? Because you said, I thought this would be the thing that changed it.
What?
Here's what I thought would be the thing that changed it. Sandy Hook. I thought when Sandy Hook happened and that, you know, someone goes into an elementary school and kills 23 kids and teachers and principals. And you got stories about, you know, they shielded them with their bodies and they found them in closets, you know, and oh my God, people will pay attention. Nope. Because it was too easy to look at it as numbers and not real people, because I didn't know them, you didn't know them. And so that it's really hard as people to extend empathy toward people that we don't know. But it's the only thing that keeps us together as a society. The only thing that makes life worth living as people, as a group of people, is caring for people that we don't know. Because the only people that I know, really, really, really know, you're talking maybe 100 some odd people. You know, if I made a list of people that I see often enough to go, yes, I know them, not just an acquaintance, but a friend, but whatever, you know, that, and that number gets smaller and smaller as we get more isolated from each other. But you have to extend empathy toward people you don't know and go, yes, they aren't like me, but I want their life to be good too. And when we lose that, man, life gets so hard, because then you don't want to pay taxes, because I don't care if your street has potholes or not. Then you don't, you know, if my school is great and yours is going to crap, I don't care, you know. That mindset is deadly to a society, because that breaks things down to a point where it's really hard to build it back up again.
And do you think it's that answer, that connectedness that we have due to the digital age? A lot of times I feel like that it made us to the point we feel like we didn't have to reach out and do that work, because the work was already done for us when we signed our emails and gave away whatever data and agreed to sign the cookies. Yeah. But I don't think that's the main thing. Part of the main thing that I realized just over reading and watching and paying attention and interviewing certain people of vastly different ages is that I can say when people became afraid of each other again, that was when people got away from one another, because there was nothing to fear. Like when we think about the war on drugs, and we think when that kicked in, like, you know, you had things to fear. You had the war on drugs, you had AIDS, you had like a picture of who, you know, who the enemy was, and it was your neighbor. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, it could have been your neighbor for the most part. But, you know, in the early generations, you had, you know, people were rallying against communism for, you know, reasons that I'll get to in another episode. People were, you know, people were rallying against, you know, the Nazis. Like, they had these large rallying points, because I've been reading this book called Tribe by Sebastian Younger. And he was talking about how people don't connect because it's not in their best interest anymore. Because you can get everything you need can be provided to you by without having to say, hi, my name is X, Y, and Z, or hi, my name is 1, 2, 3. But to the point where if you say you need a cup of sugar, or for me, I'm barbecuing, I need to get charcoal, you know, I need to go and ask my neighbors. But if you don't know your neighbor's name, you got this apprehension, like, I don't even know if they barbecue. I don't even know if they have this. I don't even know if they have that. So it was that mutual interest, if we don't have the same interest anymore, that your personality doesn't matter, because we just started seeing people as consumable at a certain point of time, as consumable and dispensable. And that's something, that's why war is so uniting. That's why when you talk about, you know, people in war, because I read a lot of Sebastian Younger books. When you talk about people in war, they remember, you know, their superiors. They remember the people who they were with, because their united force, they had the same mutual interest in keeping one another alive. The same thing, and when Nazis were bombing London, people in London, they got closer to each other and formed greater social groups to care for one another, because they shared a common method of survival. But we're so split at the ends right now, we can't even say this is what we need. Like, that is what we need. It's just so much going on that we can't handle.
It feels overwhelming.
It feels overwhelming. And if we can't buy it and purchase it, if it isn't at our disposal, then it isn't, you know, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't hold that same weight. And that's what scares me, is that we're just getting that far separated from one another, to the point where if we feel like we can't consume what another person has to offer, there is no need for us to make that interaction with that person. Like, we have nothing, you know, in common.
Yeah. It's partly like you're saying, you know, when you need to be together, need to take care of each other, need to be empathetic toward other people, that makes it a lot easier. That need is not there, but the work still needs to be done. One of the things, my wife is really good at this. She has lots of friends. They go, they hang out and stuff like that. And she reminds me on occasion, because I'm not as good at this, friendships are work, you know. And you had situations like this where if you don't take the time to get together, if you don't make emails and stuff like that on occasion, if you don't take that phone call from somebody who you know will sit there and chew your ear off, but, you know, she needs someone to talk to, if you don't make those efforts, it's real easy to lose. It's the same thing with the connections outside of those friendships. If you don't make the effort to be empathetic toward other people, care about people outside your social group, to care about other people out there, then, like you said, it is real easy to just isolate and I'm going to take care of me and mine and you guys, good luck, you know. But to me, man, that mindset is dark. That way of thinking is dark. That's not a life I want to. That's not a world I want to live in, you know. Is it easier? Yeah, it's a lot easier. But it's, I don't know.
That was rewarding.
I can't imagine thinking that way, because I wasn't raised that way. And, you know, maybe that's partly why I became a teacher, because making other people's lives better makes me happy. You know, taking care of myself is nice. Helping other people is, you know, that's part of what makes life worth living.
Oh, 100%. It separates. That's something, like you said, you mentioned that being a huge part of being a teacher is having that influence and impact upon a person's condition and how they see and form the world. Because when I was working at radio, I knew I was receiving different things from people, but I felt like what I was doing at the time wasn't impactful, and I wasn't happy because I wasn't causing a change or influencing someone's life to the extent or to the idea that I thought was purposeful and important. Yeah. And when we talk about doing that work, that's what's important about finding what we do in self-actualization, is feeling that what we do matters and what we do is important, and not as far as just as our career, but as our everyday steps, that, you know, the hellos and the, you know, the holding the doors for people, those things that they carry weight within our lives. And if we don't feel like they carry weight within our lives, we'll never be happy or self-actualized. And no matter how much you have or what you're compensated with, it can't buffer that, because being human is not a capital experience. It's a social experience and an active experience. And that's the only way you become enriched, is dealing with other people and going through things with other people, because life is an active process. And if you treat it passively, it will pass you by. More than just pass you by, you'll find out that what you had was greater than what you've received, or what you could have received was greater than what you reached out for. And those things are what really concern me. And it makes me want, like you said, you wouldn't be able to see yourself being happy, you know, if you felt and thought that way. And it brings to me an idea, and I wonder if these people are happy, or like their idea of happiness has changed. I wouldn't even say happiness, because happiness is temporary, right? Like, you can be happy for a moment. It's like joy.
But that satisfaction.
These people don't have joy.
Yeah.
That's why they vote the way they do, and that's why they act the way they do. You know, these people don't have joy because it's no connection anymore, and it's lost on them.
Yeah.
And that's just, and that in itself is exhausting. But I've kept you for a longer time than
that's all right, man.
Meant to. But next time I really want to talk, actually plug your book so we can make sure that people listen and forget it.
Yeah.
Because I want to actually, next time you come, we're going to talk about your book. I'm going to give it a deep dive.
I've got one of the best, hey, what did you do over the pandemic stories? Because my wife been trying to convince me to write a book for the longest time. I've never written anything like that. I had an idea. It sparked. I sat down. I wrote an entire novel. It's a young adult novel called My Name is Marcia. You can find it on Amazon. All you got to do is look up M-A-R-C-I-A, Marcia. It's one of the first ones that pops up. Or you can just look up Clint Chico, C-H-I-C-O, and you'll find it. It was a joy, but it was terrifying because, man, you and I have both done things creative, and you make something that you've never done before and you're not sure if it's good or not, and you put it out there. My God, the things that people have been saying, wonderful things.
Wonderful.
Somebody thanked me for putting it out into the world. And I'm like, are you kidding? Wow. Really? Wow. somebody, you know, I wish I had this book when I was a kid growing up. And every English teacher needs this book and needs to teach this to their class. All kind of wonderful, wonderful things. I mean, it inspired me more than I just wanted to write something that was fun and you know, that spoke to me. But, yeah, I've been hearing a lot of great things. You know how much it feels great when you create something and people say, not only was it good, but it was important. And I can't remember the last time that happened to me. So that's one of the best, hey, what did you do during the pandemic stories that I've ever heard. And I'm working on a sequel. So
already?
Oh, yeah. Once I started writing, I couldn't stop. And I've never experienced anything like that.
Wow. You just had like a second wind, like our runners do.
Yeah. It was nuts. So that was a lot of fun. And, it's great. Yeah.
Well, I'm definitely going to, after I finish these two Robert J. Lifton books about cults and brainwashing, I'm definitely going to dig into it because I need something less heavy.
Lighter, yes, there you go.
I definitely do. I don't know how long I can read about Chinese prisoners being brainwashed by Chairman Mao. But I'm very grateful that you came on the podcast. I'd love to have you on again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to do none of this shit without you. Like, I wouldn't have really like did it at the end of the day. Like, I was like, man, I want to act. I'm like, I don't want to, you know, shoot and edit and this, that, and the third. And I realized I was a control freak. And I was like, oh yeah, like, this is it. Like, let's do it. Like, I'm ready to get into the zone.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, I wouldn't, me and a couple of my friends, me, Khalil, Akil, Devin, we always talk about how a big influence you were upon us. I want to let you know that, you know, we love you, we honor you, and we respect you.
Thank you, man.
You know, we'll be around.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'll let you know I like the book once I'll be able to read something a little more light.
There you go. Thank you, man. All right, y'all. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. And if you're listening, remember, wear your mask, chill the fuck out, match.
That's right.